This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Program of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is January 18th, 2010. This is the second session in the oral history of Professor Paul Williams. Paul, we wanted to pick it up today as you move into your teenage years, your mid-teenage years. We had gotten you in a chronological sense through junior high when we started last week. So I wanted to ask you what your intellectual further developments are at this point and what high school is like for you.
Yes, I think as we begin to move into high school, reflecting again momentarily on the junior high as sort of a transitional set of moments might be helpful.
Okay.
In sort of organizing. Given again in that junior high was truly an expansive and expanding milieu, that sort of where kids that I hadn't grown up with in my elementary school came together from a much wider spectrum of socioeconomic and socio derivatives. As I mentioned earlier, many of the boys and girls that were in my middle school / junior high school class were what we used to call the displaced from the displaced persons, DPs, mm-hmm. was sort of the vernacular that they were attached with, from Eastern and from Western Europe as a derivative of the Second World War. These kids and their parents, and many of them only had one parent, some of them only had one parent, but the fathers for sure were working in the sawmills along the Fraser River. And there was a district called Marpole in Vancouver, which was adjacent to Kerrisdale, which was a more middle class group where the working blue collar group worked. And they came to Point Grey Junior High School, which was this large, perhaps 1,500 to 2,000 students. Mixing in the classes. As I mentioned, one of my classes was an all-boys class, and I remember the president of that class name was Boris, and he obviously came from Eastern Europe or Russia. And he had leadership qualities because even reflecting after all these years, and one suspects that he had an impact in his career. But what was happening there, again reflecting on the fact that socially I was immature, and girls were not particularly a part of the focus at that time, as they were beginning to be with many of my chums and pals as we transitioned into high school. Mm-hmm. So quite naturally, because I was interested in plants and the natural world, that began to take much sharper focus. I remember specifically because of the books I was reading, and that they tended to be connected with the arts and crafts of existing in nature, Indian lore, and I mentioned the Ernest Thompson Seton series of woodcraft that was very influential on reinforcing the cool things that I could do, because in those they were graphically illustrated with beautiful ink, hand ink drawings that would be exactly how the native Indians played their games, made their all of their living materials. Seton picked up all this, and it was sketched out and drawn. These are illustrated manuals of woodcraft for boys, and they had a very powerful influence on me. So we would attempt to live like that. Now, that coming out of elementary school into middle school, that became sort of the focus of challenge. So that even after school. Again, school was there, it was something you had to do, but it was getting out of school that was the interesting and important thing. You then returned, the war was over, you weren't fighting the Germans and the Japanese, you were, you know, playing fighting games, you were doing things. And I began to collect around me a group of boys who probably were similarly inclined. And after school, we would go off into portions of Vancouver, being on the edge of the development section of Vancouver. Beyond us was pretty much wild. There was a very large section of Vancouver which still exists just beyond Kerrisdale District, which the University of British Columbia is seated in, called the University Endowment Lands. Now, the history of that is that that large chunks, several thousands of acres of cut over second growth, now second growth, cut over in the 1880s and 1890s of the virgin Douglas fir and red cedar forests of the Pacific coast, huge, huge stumps, similar to those that were in my own garden, in, as I described earlier. That forest was second growth, which meant that these trees were in the order of 50 to 60 to 70 years old, and in that tropical, in that Pacific Northwest rainforest, an 80-year-old Douglas fir was a very large tree, even as a second growth tree. And even today, those are what are being logged in British Columbia and Washington State. It's not the virgin forest. They are long gone or preserved as parks, as second growth wood that is, and tertiary growth wood even now, because these large Pacific coast trees grow so ideally in their own. Okay, so this large endowment land was a vast, empty forest. There were one or two bridle trails cut through it, but otherwise nothing. And you could go for miles in this forest. Well, as kids, on the edge of that forest, what a great place to build forts, find all sorts of things. There were streams in there that salmon spawned in. There were trout ponds with real trout in it. And these were only a few minutes by bike away from my home.
Wow.
Additionally, I had around me a group of usually younger boys. And again, this is interesting that I was the older boy, but still immature. But these would be boys who were a grade younger. Uh-huh. So as I moved into high school, they would be in junior high. As I moved into upper levels, these boys would be in high school. And I just hung out with them. They were just my buddies. Mm-hmm. But where did we hang out? We hang out at Jerry Logan's farm, helping him milk the cows after school. We'd go out and hunt the ducks that were on his farm. And I, in the course of high school, connected deeply enough, being coached, if you like, or inspired by Ernest Thompson Seton's books, that I could trap muskrats. And so I started a little trap line on the tidal ditches that were on the delta region after the slope of Vancouver came off. There was the delta region along the banks of the Fraser River, this great river that flows out of the interior of British Columbia. And the delta is basically what Vancouver has occupied. In fact, the district, if you're in Vancouver today, it's called Delta. And these are two or three or four huge islands of sedimentary delta materials that are now basically urbanized. But before that time, they were wild territory. And as a kid, that whole delta territory was part of my domain. There was a few farms on it, but basically it was just rough, uninhabited land with jack pines on it. The great forests and the second growth forests were on the slopes where there was drainage and alluvial soil, but on the delta it was jack pine and peat bogs. And these are all peat bogs. That there were some blueberry farms, some cranberries, and a few dairy farms, and that was it. And then Vancouver Airport was on one of these islands. So if you fly into Vancouver today, you fly in on the Delta region of the... Well, all of that domain was basically mine and my buddy's domain after school. So it was after school that it happened. Now, that was during the week. But during the weekends, or long holidays, certainly Christmas, Easter, and all summer, in junior high and high school, it was on my bike, with my bike, on the boat to Vancouver Island, to the home farm of the people that I met, the Groves, at Qualicum Beach. And I became the third son with their two boys on this farm.
Oh, yes.
And that farm, there the habits of mind and the heritage and the lineage was very, very British. As I said, the grandfather lived on a nearby farm, and he was the second son. The father had come back from the war. He was a timber cruiser. Not, he wasn't a timber cruiser. He was a logging engineer, excuse me, and working on specific jobs. So he would go off into the woods and design a logging road for a timber company, and then come back and tend his, as a gentleman farmer, his herd of Hereford beef cattle. So he ran a small beef cattle operation that the two boys, his sons, and I basically managed with him throughout Christmas. So I had the dairying during the week and beef on my off time, and in between roamed around with a bunch of kids who loved nature. So that was my immersion as junior high. Reading what I did about how cool it was to connect the things you read about with that, of course, the trap line was sort of the real quintessential entry point, because I'd read about how people trapped and what the Indians did with the skins and how you did all this. Well, one thing to read it, another thing to do it.
Was there a market for muskrat?
Well, pelts? Was there a market for muskrat pelts? You bet. And the interesting thing is that one just had to, on one's own, I mean, I've got two brothers and they're doing their thing. My older brother, you know, out with the boys who are out for the girls and sports and athletics. Younger brother connecting with his buddy and kind of interested in what his middle brother was doing, but not quite doing it yet. But I was just sort of out there doing all of this, plus the gardening piece that I talked about as an elementary. So I was never without a doing thing. Now, if I were to interpret myself, even now after all these years, I'm kind of a doer more than a philosopher. Rather than somebody who thought about it and things, I would just keep doing it. So I had many, many things that I was doing at any one time. And as I look back over my career, that's kind of how I still like to live. Mm-hmm. So through high school, what was I doing in school? I enjoyed shop enormously. We talked about that through junior high, rather, and then that sort of set up and challenged my tactile and the doing thing. High school, we came away from this large junior high into a high school that was servicing the Caresdale, just a portion of the Caresdale district, and definitely it was positioned where an upper white-collar clientele of parents. Nice homes, professional families, and my father being a doctor, a professional, very much part of that. And so high school, McGee High School, is largely students like that. With
smaller
one
than the junior high?
Much, much smaller. Okay. High school about a quarter or less than the size of the junior high. It's almost like going back to elementary school. A very interesting model, I think, different than we'd see in many U.S. cities today, and certainly in Madison. So you're back to a cohort of kids, but slightly different kids, because they're just on the face of another district of Vancouver. So, but all upper middle class kids, and therefore pretty much focused for the general curriculum within that high school, not exclusively, with what would have been said professional development, futures, careers, university, doing stuff. Mm-hmm. And you never know it at the time that that's the way it's set up. Mm-hmm. So life changed from junior high, which was setting the stage for lots of activity and lots of mixing, to a high school where academics suddenly raised their heads. So this is where I first became aware that there was something academic. And I think the most critical part of that was that instead of taking shop, now my parents, and of course I wasn't guiding the choices or selections even at that stage, as I reflect on it, my father had a very powerful influence on saying, well, here's the kind of courses you're going to take. Your brother, who had 2 years ahead of you, had taken this, this, and this, and this is what you're going to take. So it was clear to those around me that I wasn't going to take the shop course. It was pretty clear, again, you didn't realize you were being tracked, but tracking was going on. Mm-hmm. So what did my dad said? Well, you're going to take Latin, and you're going to take social studies, which is sort of the standard, and you're going to take the sciences, and you'll take all of these, and the standard curriculum, which was in British Columbia, pretty solid curriculum in the high school. So I took 4 years of Latin, took math, all the math you could take, took all the science you could take, which is general science, and then chemistry, biology, and physics, and you took all of the other things. Precious little shop, the things I loved.
Paul, had you come into the high school with the record of this is a bright boy?
It's you don't know who you are at that age. Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, I was keen, I think. And it became very clear to me in high school that, A, I wasn't among the top students. Mm-hmm. There were these really smart kids. But I was always in those classes. But I would have said I was like a B student. Uh-huh. And not at that time really conscious of the fact that grades and academic were that important. I was doing too many things when I wasn't in school. So I'm still reflecting on whether I was bored in school. But I wouldn't have been surprised that I found out of school more interesting than in school. Mm-hmm. And that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. But that was the way it seemed to be.
Noteworthy teachers or courses,
yes,
in high school?
Yes. There's one quintessential teacher who really turned me on, and that was my high school biology teacher, Mrs. Evelyn McCluckie. I still remember her name, in fact, and I guess I was sufficiently unusual by virtue of the fact that here was this boy that was just interested in everything that she talked about, that she definitely encouraged me. Mm-hmm. But I remember, I did well. I mean, I did pretty well in high school, but I certainly wasn't among the ones we called the brains. Mm-hmm. But I was definitely, by the time I arrived in high school, because it's interesting, I just recently had the opportunity of looking back to the junior high graduating class, which I wasn't even aware of until we started to think about it, website, where the high school website even has a website of the junior high, and they have a photograph, and then they had a little one-liner for each kid in junior high of the age. Just the editor of that junior high yearbook had put just a one-line phrase with every kid. And I went up and looked at that picture, and I couldn't believe it, what it was. But it said, Paul Williams, nature boy. That's how my peers apparently perceived me in those days. So I found that interesting. So obviously they were aware of the fact that I was doing that. And I must say, I have in a small dossier at home a couple of pieces that came out of an English class in junior high, where I had been asked to write an essay in one case, and another one where I'd been asked to write a poem. And these I kept for some reason. And because the teacher had said, this is a very interesting essay, and this poem is beautiful. She'd written those remarks on them. Mm-hmm. And they were both poems and essays about nature and about animals and how they interacted and so on. And this was like written in seventh or eighth grade. So obviously some things were forming.
Yes.
And the ability to write about them and write creatively about them were shaping, even though around me, I took the world around me. I guess this is the way to interpret it. I would interpret it. I was taking the world around me, which was the world that was outside of school, and when given an opportunity and some organization or some direction by a teacher to organize it and put it down on paper, I put it always in those terms. So it was connectivity to nature.
Yes, that's kind of exceptional, I think, for children of that age to do that.
It may be, I just don't know. So it certainly rang bells in the teachers because they took the time to write little comments on them. Why I kept them now over these years is another question that's of interest. Mm-hmm. I have no idea, except they're in there, and I was just flipping through in preparation and sort of saying, what have I got up that I've kept all these years? Mm-hmm. And those are a few of them. So notable people, Mrs. McLucky for sure, because I just loved everything she did, and I obviously made an extra effort in that class to do things that were beyond what other students were doing. Partly because here I was a guy out there in the wild and bringing in stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I brought a lot of stuff apparently into class, and she would use it. So there was a very positive feedback loop, and I remember me skinning out at one point in my trap line a weasel that I'd caught. Mm-hmm. Normally the muskrats were trapped, they were skinned according to the rules and so on, and stretched. And you were asking earlier, where did they go? Was there a market? Yeah, I would take these down to Water Street, which was this part of Vancouver that was along the waterfront, very rough part of town where the longshoremen would come in, where there were prostitutes. And it was a very rough and ready waterfront of the old waterfront style. The drunks were all over the streets. Now it was the drug district of Vancouver and is still probably. But it's literally right in the corner if you go to Vancouver, British Columbia, to what's now called Gastown. Well, one of those storefronts in Gastown was a fur buyer. Because people from all over British Columbia came in with their furs. I mean, this is just beyond the fringe of Vancouver was the wilderness. That was what's so cool about it. And there were people making their livelihood, trappers and people. Okay, so I would take my muskrat skins down there, and on a good year, and the buyer would give me 90 cents for a skin. And for me, that was a lot of money. If I had a dozen skins, that was $12 or so, you know, and I could do something with that. All the time I'm doing the trap line and learning about it. I'm raising the rabbits at home, skinning them, selling the meat. I'm raising the blue poppies, because that's the gardening piece of the legacy. So there's nature, there's gardening, and there's production, and this is like Paul's little farming enterprise, nursery, revisited and rekindled every time I went to the farm across on Vancouver Island on the long holidays. So it's a very rich mix of a lot of activities for a kid doing all this. And then marketing this stuff. Well, you know, that's all going to come to roost when we slow forward 50, 60 years to the spawning of the Fast Plant Enterprise. And the design of how to make a set of ideas of higher value than just ideas.
That's precisely why we're doing this.
And now this is the first time I've ever had a chance to sort of reflect on how come we set up the Fast Plant program, and now how come it's as far-reaching as it is, and why do I have a very fascinating, intricate relationship with this that has never come out on paper that you won't know about. It's mm-hmm. all got an economic component plus an intellectual and academic component. Mm-hmm. And what's the benefactors of that model? So it's very interesting just reflecting on what the roots of the behavior and the decision making that led me to be where we are today.
And that's why these components are the most interesting part.
And probably the most important.
No question.
And so, I mean, we're hardly, you said take me through high school, but now I'm really telling you all about my life out of high school, mm-hmm. out of middle school. What are the deep-seated roots? And I'm beginning to understand that because I'm saying Mr. Evans and the plants connected. A boy of 8 or 9 years old with a mentor who was kindly and patient and understanding. A high school teacher who was excited to get, you know, stuff that no other kid in class would bring her. I remember taking this skinned, so I couldn't sell a weasel pelt because they weren't worth anything. Muskrat was worth 90 cents, and weasels in the winter in Vancouver, they didn't want a brown weasel skin. In Vancouver, it was cold, so warm through the winters that the weasels never turned into ermine. And ermine was what they wanted. And that's what a weasel under cold climate sheds his summer coat and grows a white winter coat. And an ermine skin is just a little ermine that can be used to adorn the robes of you-know-who, aristocracy throughout history, with a little black tip on the tail. And if you've seen the ermine in the paintings, and you have, that was a mark of... So they would buy ermine pelts, but they didn't want weasel pelts. So I said, okay, I will just go to my woodland lore books that Ernest Thompson Skeaton showed me, and how to skin a weasel and how to stuff a weasel. And so I would do the taxidermy on the things that weren't wanted. Take those to my science teacher. And of course she loved them because she now had specimens.
Yes.
Not only that, I learned how to take the skeletons of the plant, the animals I had. And so I would clean the skeletons and boil them and take all the flesh off them and then put them back together. And took those to my high school teacher.
Well, I bet she was thrilled. Because she, it sounds like she was a scientist.
She was, of course. And of course, a science teacher that doesn't do science today, this is my insight. And of course, that's why I'm training science teachers, is because I know that the great science teachers of today are not just talking about their discipline, but they're doing it with their children. And that's what is my driving motivation as a man in his 70s. Because I know that science is doing, it's not talking about doing. And what we do far too much in science today is talk about how to do science, but we never get kids doing it. You know, we do in some cases. We're struggling to try to figure out how to get kids to do it. That is what the School of Education is about. That's what I've been about in the last 20 years, is trying to figure out how to translate what really motivated me as an 8, 9, 10, 18-year-old and capture that within me, keep it preserved, and then try to figure out what to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's been my life. Mm-hmm. That will carry me on. That's because that has not been, haven't figured it out yet.
No.
No one knows how to do it. No. This country hasn't figured it out.
No.
Isn't that interesting? So,
very.
Isn't that a reasonable quest? I mean, that's why I retired.
More than reasonable.
That's why I retired from plant pathology, because I had too many important things to do. Now, this is jumping ahead, but it's when you realize that what you began to capture, you realize it took you a long time to realize who you were and what made you in these early formative years. If you realize that when you're now 50 years later, and you can ask the question, you haven't lost it, you now know what it was, can you recover it, or can you reflect on that in such a way that you can regain some insight into how to maintain or change the way that happens in your society, then haven't you got an obligation to try to figure out how to do it? So that's the science, again, of figuring out how to do science.
Yes.
And they may say that's sort of a meta-analysis. Well, okay, that's a meta-analysis, but that's what it's all about. If you've gained an insight over a lifetime and figured out what you think you really need to do, and in the course of that's been a lifetime, but you haven't done it, then the last few years you have, where you think you've got a better set of knowledge of how to do it, better be spent doing it. And so why do I come to the campus every day in retirement for the last 13 years? It's trying to figure out what happened when I was an adolescent.
Yes.
And I hope that running this tape will leave some sort of a record of that, so somebody can pick up on that and figure out because I'm not going to probably do it in my lifetime, but if we can put enough of the insights from this great project together that you're running, Bob, maybe that will happen.
It might.
Maybe it will happen. But at least I'm leaving a raw product, as I say.
You are.
For somebody to sift and winnow. Mm-hmm. In the Wisconsin metaphor.
Yeah.
Right? That's what this is all about.
It is indeed.
Okay, so I'm roaming around, but I think it's the roaming around these issues that is the pure essence of what needs to be left on this tape.
Correct. Yeah, because we can read what's been written about you, what is objective as to what you've accomplished.
No.
What we're trying to get.
You want the raw product.
Correct.
You want the mother lode. Yeah. So you go back and you say, well, why did I keep these little pieces of writing? Well, obviously, my own analysis would be that English teacher in seventh grade who suddenly said, that's a beautiful poem you wrote, Paul, or the fed back to my psyche that said, you know, do something and you're rewarded for it internally. And there's the psychological rewards that so you gravitate to the things that stimulate you, and we did that outside, and nature was deeply, deeply connected, but not just pure nature, through the reading of the books and the wanting to try them out. So there's this. It's not good enough just to read about it, but I must do this. I must participate. And so I raised the rabbits, and that never stopped through my professional career and doesn't today. Again, an aside, but the one sort of place that all teachers who come to know me have to come is to my basement, which is in my home. And when they see it, they can't believe what they're seeing. But they're surrounded by all of these things that are really still part of my youth. So in my basement, I'm growing all these insects, fish, plants. I'm surrounded by it constantly, which are sort of a harken back to this very early period. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
It's fascinating.
And so kids, I mean, they say, a teacher, this science house that we're sitting in now is sort of a window to my basement. And so you see things in here and here, and I bring people in who have the potential to connect with the natural world, and the aquarium over there is part of the Madison Aquatic Gardening Club. Then there's this group and that group who call this home, because I want people to mix and share. Okay, so we're a long way off high school now, I realize that.
But a question that I have for you is, were you respected, ignored, harassed by your peers for your interests?
That's a really great question. And I think I may put it in, and my parents?
And your parents.
So, because if you put this kind of a guy in a contemporary feeling, you think, well, where did he come from? Mm-hmm. And so this cohort of boys, I'm going to analyze this as best I can. It kind of gets into the psychology of all this, which is the important part. My father liked the world according to him. You know, ordered, neat, predictable. Mm-hmm. My mother, obviously, very devoted to her boys, but to my father, too, really devoted. So she ran a very neat, ordered house. Mm-hmm. And then she had her social life among her peers, who were the young ladies of Vancouver, I'll put it that way. You know, so there was a social structure there, mm-hmm. that was evident that you were somebody. And you had nice things, and you had a nice house. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of ordered and regulated. I think my father liked that kind of a life, you know. So it was very professional. And here's me kind of just pushing the boundaries for this drive, for raising this and growing this and doing that.
Yes.
So there were always limits put on things. You know, you could do this, but you had to do it this way. You could have animals, but you couldn't have them in the house. That would be dirty or smelly. Mm-hmm. Okay, can I have a little space here? Yeah, okay. Oh, there's a little space over in a vacant lot over there. And my, you know, could I go over and, well, go talk to the person who owns the vacant lot and see if they'll let you put a garden in there. Okay, knock, knock, I would go and do that. Yes, you can have a garden. What kind of a garden? Thank you very much. So I'd go over with a spade and dig up a piece of land on a, plant some things, grow them. I when I reflect on how many sort of things I did like that, it was quite a lot. Where am I going to raise the rabbits? Rabbits are smelly. Are you going to clean them out? You know, what, you know, this is a beautiful, you know, this is, like I said, like a really nice house, a nice Tudor-built house with a fronting, like a Nakoma, you know, or a Maple Bluff house. You're not going to raise rabbits and make a farm out of my garden. Okay, well, where can I put it? Out of sight. Always limits. When I got out of that place, and that's my domain, I live in that. So it's all for to figure out how to do it in small and limited ways, but doing it. You can have this much of the driveway to grow your blue poppies, but because, you know, they're going to be in flats and, you know, keep them out of the way of turning the car around, but there was always this. Okay, well, I figured that out and carried on, kept going. Over on Vancouver Island, boom, just the total opposite. Unlimited domain, no limits, chickens running everywhere, cows coming and going. But internally, a much more interesting dynamic of people who were talking about the way that life was, but highly stratified social domains, deep prejudice against Jews, deep, you know, my father, on the other hand, practicing as a public health officer, you know, the traditions, but the old English Victorian ethic around those tables, you know, Germans, I just come back from the war. This is Mr. Groves now speaking. Very English and sort of, what is a man? A man is a person who does these things which are in the Anglophile, you know, nature, you know, from the great English school tradition. These boys that I went to private English schools until they came to this farm. Then they went to the public schools, and there were anomalies in the public schools in Vancouver Island, because they were bright, really bright boys. Both of them went on to get PhDs. But what did an English boy do? Well, you read Tom Brown's School Days, and you learned about what it was like at rugby, and, you know, and all of the machinations that went on in the systems of the English boarding school. So when we drop over to Vancouver Island two, three times a year for long, protracted stays with these kids, it was kind of, you know, here's how you've got to do a man's work even though you're a boy, and tea would be served to you. It was all regular in that English tradition. It was very interesting, double dynamic this life, and I loved it.
Shades of the Empire,
totally. I mean, these boys, I remember them saying that, well, we're going over to Granny Groves' house, these were the Groves farm. But Granny Groves had the farm about 5 miles away. And she was super quintessential British. We have to put on our British accents when we have supper with Granny Groves. And so the kids had practiced and taught me how to say water, not water. Pass the water, please. I mean, it was...
You still do it very well.
You know, well, these are things that are just coming to memory. But the interesting is that Tom Groves was a man who was sort of a man's man, and you know, and so those boys were striving, you know, so they all would go out for, you know, this is after doing like all the farm work, you know, and feeding and haying and so on during the summer. We'd go for a run so that we could, like the cross country team, after doing all this, because that's what boys did. Well, you know, you read back, this is reading history of Prince Charles, you know, and the abuses associated with his teenage and growing up,
yes,
laid on him by his father and his mother, the schools that were, probably.
It's very sad.
It's sad, I mean, when you think of the monarchy, but at the same time, you realize how powerful that tradition was. And so I was slaloming along the edge of that British tradition and experiencing it as a teenager in my own life. And then counterpoint, back into Vancouver, where I had emulated the miniature farm and the growing and the need to, you know, I would carry home cages of field mice that we captured and figured out how to raise back to Vancouver. Not in my house, but out there in the garden and garage, you could have a few of these things. So that was it. So it was always a challenge, but the drive to seed was there. That went on in high school. And that was far more stimulating and interesting, I think, than school itself.
Now, did your parents think that you were kind of an odd child?
No, I don't think so, because there were two brothers, younger, and we were just boys who were always, you know, at loggerheads. Mm-hmm. Interesting, again, this is reflecting on family, which I think has got to be part of it. I mean, it's what the three brothers today are really close brothers, and yet we were always fighting, mm-hmm. you know, in our memories. The younger brother and myself are much closer, and he's a doctor, and my older brother's a successful businessman in Toronto, and does very interesting creative things, very creative guy, and makes a lot of money. But the discipline that went on in our house, if we just got out of line, then it was sort of the old-fashioned, traditional kind of discipline, like go to your room and you are to write me 500 lines or 100 lines. It was lines. You know, this was the kind of stuff we did, so I will not do this, or I will, and you'll do it 100 times. When we think of it today, it's bizarre, such an anachronism. Or later, I mean, my father was probably striving to discipline these kids, you know, in their teens. But then later, it was discipline like, you're going to write an essay. So now you're going to write essays instead of lines on subject matter. And we have to go to our room and sit down at our desks and write essays on, and he would read the essays. Can you imagine that?
I can't, actually. I know about writing on the lines, but writing an essay, I don't know about.
As a disciplinarian.
As a disciplinarian.
I mean, it would probably drove me deeper and farther out of any literary potential, whatever existed. And these are just fleeting memories of middle and high school years.
So, Paul, what about the perception of you by your fellow students?
Yes. I think clearly most of them, I was a person who didn't, I think I was sort of neutrally perceived, I would have said. Mm-hmm. There's Nature Boy. He's doing all these things after school. He's not taste in the girls or interested or a period. Girls just, you know, were these strange creatures. Mm-hmm. Interested in the doing the shop work with the boys. There were one or two girls who said interested in me in high school because they were different. Mm-hmm. You know, but I wasn't particularly interested. I was too busy doing all this interesting stuff. And then going on. So their perceptions, it's very hard for me to perceive that. In fact, what's an interesting reflection for me is now having had a second or third set of invitations to return for like 50th and 55th class reunions, uh-huh. and getting looking at those and sort of thinking about the guys I knew and who I was buddies with and one thing and another, to reflect more deeply on them. And I think generally I was sort of a pleasant, sort of fairly innocuous presence, uh-huh. in classes, with the exception of the knowledge that, you know, that's the kid who has all these things going on after school. So again, an anecdote that would give you a reflection of the kind of stuff that we did in school. Pranks in class were common in certain, if a teacher I'm not saying permitted them, but if a teacher was known that, you know, kids did things that today they wouldn't get away with in those days. I mean, when I got to college, hazing, you know,
yeah.
big piece of life at UBC, and all of that was part of the tradition. So anyway, so academically, I gravitated quite clearly to a younger group of boys, usually a year younger than me, which is why in the early stages, I said, I think I was disadvantaged in being a year younger than most of the other students around me.
Uh-huh.
And it would be interesting to reflect on a different life. So an inherently a boy who was immature, uh-huh. in terms of development. Obviously interested in bright enough to do all kinds of interesting things. And the group of boys I hung out with at junior high and high school were not as academically inclined, but were active and liked the outdoors. And I clearly brought a dimension to that group because of the things that I could bring to that group in terms of my insight. And I was doing, you know, the trapping and doing it and raising these things. And these kids would, to more or less degree, do some of that, but none of them would ever do it to the degree and extent that I would. So there was just a series of growing by doing and learning by doing, and then off to the farm and more challenges and weekends. As all of that was going on the weekends, my parents, as I referred to earlier, were still looking for after Sunday. So Sundays, right after the war and in our elementary and middle school youth, were, you know, pretty rigid, but life across society began to ease up. And so Sundays weren't as blue as they once were. Movie theaters opened up and things of that sort. And I think our arranging as a family moved. So Sundays were still spent exploring until a point about in the middle of, just in early high school, my parents found a piece of land that they liked and were able to purchase. And it was about 30 acres of cut-over forest in the lower Fraser Valley, which is about 30 miles out of Vancouver by road. And so here's a high school boy and his younger brother, very much in that vein. And so in addition to the stuff we did during the week, on weekends, accompanied by my parents, we would drive to this 30 acres of forested land, which had a beautiful stream on it. The stream was called the Salmon River, and it was a natural spawning area for salmon coming up the Fraser River.
Oh, wow.
So that in of itself, and it was the site of just the remnants and literally remnants of an ancient sawmill on this landed site across the river, where in the 1890s and 80s, the virgin forest had been cut up and sawed and distributed for the expansion of the towns around the lower Fraser Valley. So this was just moldering into the woods, wilderness, and with trees growing up through it and everything. But it was a wonderful place because there was a little piece of field, and so that domain of field, through my high school and later through my university years, became a center of focus for my horticultural and plant-based interests. I began then to move from this massive sort of growing of plants and or animals and raising rabbits, and my last sort of deviant diversion of high school as was the last day of school. Prior to that time, I'd been raising white mice at home, and I had tons of white mice. I just loved them. What to do with them? Well, I had a crazy mind, prankster mind. I said, you know, I know these kids get 15 cents for their lunch, a chocolate bar, so what if I brought all these white mice and empty bottles and showed them how to raise them and sold them for 15 cents each to kids in the school with the notion that they could let them go in the classes as they left school that day, because that was the last day of school. This story's never been told before, but it gives you a characteristic of who I am.
Yeah.
There's all this sort of like, let's do something kooky, crazy, let's try something. So I brought all these bottles of white mice to school, and I sold them to the kids, with this notion that, you know, they could take them home if they wanted, but wouldn't it be more of a kind of a neat thrill to just let them go and see what happened in the school? So, you know, I can't even remember what the outcome of that was. But there were later derivatives of this that I will narrate when I was a grown man with a family, still raising other species that had equally interesting and bizarre consequences right here on and off the UW-Madison campus.
I will look forward to hearing. There you go.
Yeah, so again, The point is that where the heck would a kid in high school come up with all these mice or whatever it was to do something that seemed like a creative, I view it as sort of one of these creative outputs that sort of said, well, you know, what the heck? So there's an element here, I don't know how you psychologically...
Yes, that's hard to quantify.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people who would raise mice, but, and so everyone could look at the mice that one were raising. It's a very small subset who would think about bottling them, selling them, with a grand plan to disrupt the last day of school.
Exactly.
I'm not,
Bob.
Fun of you. It's,
no,
you're looking at something and you're seeing it quite differently from what most people who raise mice would think.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to get a contemporary psychologist to analyze that for us. little do they know what a dangerous person they have on their hands.
Yeah, somebody who thinks. But now, Paul, I also want to ask you to address the issue of randomness, and maybe it's not random. It sounds like it was fortunate for you that your parents bought that piece of land.
Very interesting insight. It was great. It was fortunate. What a nice way of putting it. And for ways that later I will explain, the notion of intent, and my father comes back deeply into this as my life plays out. Okay? So why did my father buy that land? Very hard to know, except that my analysis of that was that inherently in many of us, in North America, I will put, because I don't think there's a distinction between Canadians and which I was, and Americans. There's a deep sense of value placed on owning land. Nobody would dispute that.
Correct.
And coming out of the war, as I said, these men who had been put into that mold, or men who had come up as my father had, from very modest means, the first generation of an education and intelligence moving them into there was an acquisitiveness associated with that, which I think in my father, there was a strong yin and a yang to that about his own career, because as I'll narrate to you, I think his career and mine, his career had a very powerful impact on perhaps decisions I made later, unbeknownst to me, but then later reflected on. Because he very soon after this is stepping ahead a bit, but he about the time that the land was purchased and we finally stopped exploring on Sundays with our picnics, then what to do with this land? Well, one of the things that he enjoyed doing was using that weekend for physical work. You know, get into the gardening and do some real gardening. Okay, so we had two young, burgeoning young teenage boys. My older brother sort of gravitated away into the social domains. Hung out with a bunch of guys who were like sports, played basketball, did all the kinds of things, and this is interesting to say this, in Canada, that American boys did. Interesting way of looking at it. The perception was that the Yankees did that, Canadians did this. So my older brother would play, and this is going back a little to junior high and high school, he played lacrosse, box lacrosse, tough game. He played hockey, but Vancouver doesn't have much ice very often, but in a rink. He broke his leg playing, on the school grounds of junior high. He was the bigger brother, the little guy, kind of tough and with the world. And he turned out to be a businessman. Took his master's from Northwestern here after graduating in commerce, which is business school from UBC, and then went back and started in the business world with Eaton's company as a marketing specialist. And then when Eaton's was sold off, went into his own business, and he now has this very successful business out of Toronto, which redirects and restores shopping centers around the world. So he and his wife are major consultants for rejuvenation and marketing of shopping centers. So he's been successful. But so this guy went off and leaving the two brothers, who were much more under the control, if you want, of the influence of their parents. So the land was purchased, beautiful piece of forest with trout on the stream and salmon coming up and spawning and all the great things that are interesting, and a nice piece of level land where my parents could set up a little garden and begin to do something with the land. So the two boys who gained their skills in what to do with land over on the Groves Farm on Vancouver Island, suddenly then, as they got older, gravitated on weekends, still went to the Vancouver Island to pick up the skills of how to take a large cedar that was lying, a virgin cedar that had fallen over in the swamp and was preserved by the swamp for 50 years, how to make fence posts and cedar shakes and barns and buildings out of that tree with handmade crosscut saws, everything by hand. The pride in doing it was to do it by hand. Don't use a machine. Do it the way the pioneers did it. So that ethos, do it, make it yourself. All of this stuff can be made by hand. That's derivative, no question in my mind now, still exists deeply within me, was the success of the Bottle Biology Project, which of all my projects today, as we speak, has wider global influence than any other. That manual which sits over there, Bottle Biology, is translated into many languages and is of great interest to the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Koreans, and the Thai people. How to get kids making their own science equipment, because in the making of it is the entry point to technology, which is the career of engineering. It's the producing of, it's the overcoming, technology is the overcoming of the limiting effects of constraints. Science is about asking questions and wondering, and the two become a partnership. You wonder how something happens in the world, you figure out how you might answer that question, but you need something to help you to do that, technology. And so you create things to overcome those, to enable you to get to the answer to the question. It's the marriage of science and with technology that is really the fundamental product that results in what we call progress today. Well, that goes on every single farm, and 50 years ago it went on differently than it goes on today.
Right.
And throughout the time that you and I were growing up, it was focused, and throughout the following many years, the greatest piece of technology for training boys was an old car. Take it apart, figure out how the engine worked, work it, you know. And the shop classes that we took in high school and junior high were how to fix the toaster. You know, how to make this little tool, this flipper. You started with a spatula in metalwork so you could flip your eggs and pancakes, and then you went up to make other things. That was really the guide to technology. And so I loved that. So I made all my rabbit cages, and I made this,
oh,
and I
did.
Made that. So nothing, but the challenge was to do it. And that, in reflecting as I am now, I'm at a meta for reflecting, when I arrived here to go to grad school, which we will get to, I think maybe if you read through the, I started over here in that T18, I tell you, and had to do certain work, fairly sophisticated. I would just say, oh, I can make that, and I would go in and make my own equipment. And I think some of the professors around me sort of thought, whoa, this guy could just do it on his own. I don't have to worry about it. You know, so I think it's that ability that probably was a factor into saying, stick around here, we could use you.
We'll get to that later.
This piece of land, I'm sorry, you know, you just have to ask the right question as you do so skillfully.
Oh, thank you.
And it triggers this cascade of connectivity, which I think is what you want.
It is precisely what I want. So don't stop.
Okay, so this cascade of how on earth could a piece of land, which is a choice by my father, to satisfy his desire to do some more fundamental gardening, something he'd probably been waiting for the war to end on, and suddenly he now has, but he gets a piece of garden. He doesn't get a piece of island property like so many of his peers were doing out of the military. The peers would say form enclaves of other military people, often an island where they would all go for a month or two and have a great time together. My father, very much a loner. We'll explore and find a place. Here's a little patch of land out in the middle of nowhere. I'm going to just set this up. Now I've got two boys who seem able, and it's about 35 miles out of Vancouver by car and a ferry. We take a ferry across the Fraser River because there isn't a bridge yet or a tunnel. Those are all tunnels now entering Vancouver from the United States. We had to take them by ferry. And in high school, Donald and I, my younger brother, would go out there and we'd spend the days with mom and dad splitting and putting fencing the place. But we knew how to fence because we learned how to fence at Grove's Farm.
Yes.
So we'd put up the posts and dig them in. And then what do you do with a place that, well, you'd thin out the tree. We made the fence posts from that. And then we would, so it was work, but work was what we loved. Good things for teenagers to do.
Yes, you were not resentful, it doesn't
no,
sound like.
No.
You were engaged.
I couldn't wait to get out that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And, you know, we'd sometimes sleep out there, but generally we came home because our parents were driving. They'd carry us out and we'd work home Saturday or Sunday. And then the gardens would come in. You know, what to put in the gardens? Well, I knew how to grow things from seed. And then I began to learn how to, because remember I said I was reading my monthly edition of the Royal Horticultural Society's.
Yes, I do remember.
Gardener's Chronicle. The Gardener's Chronicle you see over there in Steenbach is just a gold mine for some kid who wanted to. So what was I going to be through high school? I wasn't going to go to college. I was going to have a fishing boat on an island in Vancouver, in British Columbia, and raise the most beautiful plants and fish salmon and just have this idyllic existence. And my parents never said, no, you're not. They just said, well, just keep on going. Next step is, you know, you're going to take Latin because everything you read in the Gardener's Chronicle is Latin. And I knew what they all meant. All the plant names
sure
made sense to me. It all perfectly came together. You said, so what did my boys take when they went to West High? Latin. One ended up a doctor and the other a scientist, and French. They use it. This wasn't, what didn't I take? The greatest thing I wish I'd taken, but it wasn't socially what you would take if you were going to college. Typing. If you took typing in middle school or high school, you were going to become a secretary. It was just that simple. Isn't that amazing?
When I was in high school in the early 60s in Houston, Texas, the secretarial class, there was one boy who took typing.
Yeah.
And he was endlessly mocked.
Yeah.
He probably now is a CEO of Silicon Valley.
Exactly. But you see, these are habits of mind that generations carry with them.
Yes.
And, you know, again, if you rationalize it, which I think is a fair analysis in this point, of a father who came from simple means, who had sons who had potential, he didn't know what, but he was going to be darn sure that whatever potential was there was exercised in their development, so typing wasn't on the screen.
Correct.
So you took Latin instead of typing. Okay.
Right.
Interesting. How are we doing? Okay.
Fine.
So moving through high school, there was nothing, you know, as you can see, the thing, I enjoyed social studies, I struggled with mathematics, I enjoyed gym because, you know, we had to get out and run and as they do today, and I always, because of the deep sort of edge and competitiveness which my walking colleagues, running colleagues claim I have, and which I deny I have, but which I admit I have, probably was honed to a very fine edge because of my relationships with groves. Because the English thing, there's a book written, How to Be Top, you know, and it's all the things you do to succeed as a young English, you know, entitled person. You know, there's that element. If you read deep, or even not deep now, read Sarah Lyall's book on the English, and there are lots of contemporary analyses of the British by writers and English and sociologists about, you know, this anomalous nation, the Brits, who are they, what are they? And I've been reading some of that, and I say, oh, it's also true, and I see it. So I'm sort of an Anglophile because of my roots, but at the same time, you begin to understand it. So I was immersed in that. So in a very Victorian way that, you know, you, a man's a man, and you know, you don't, you stiff upper lip, and you don't admit the pain when you feel it, and all of this sort of stuff, big time. And that was in spades with the groves. I mean, that was, and so I was on the periphery and didn't get too much of it, but I got enough of it so that I really enjoyed just, you know, in high school, just competing until I died. But I wasn't athletic in any way. So it was a matter of just getting out there and doing it, that piece. That's a strange piece of a complex psyche, but it's no different than kids wanting to exceed in basketball.
It's all those developmental components, the mind, the soul, the body.
Yeah, the motivation.
All happening at the same time.
Yeah, all happening and exploding. But when I reflect on it, the thing that was totally missing, and you know, and why I consider myself just privileged and fortunate, there was none of the contemporary distractions that we see in this day, notably, originally, not television. Now, in high school, that came into my life, but not in my family. And then later, the internet and everything else is a distracting factor in kids' lives. It's hard to do the contemporary balance. Because mm-hmm. when I was finished with school or walked out of there, I got on my bicycle and went to these massive numbers of things that I had to do as kids. The gardening, the growing, the farms, this, that, and there was never ever any time when I would sit and get bored. Mm-hmm. I was very lucky. So everything, it was a learning experience.
Paul, were you ever identified by either of your parents or any teachers or counselors as exceptional or possessing a special talent?
I suspect my parents might have seen some of that, but I don't think I was ever, I was not aware of being identified as having any special gifts or abilities or talents. Just went on and did it. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting because in those days we were aware that from time to time we would be tested, and we never knew what the results were mm-hmm. as kids, but you took an IQ test in elementary school, I think, and maybe you took something else. But I remember toward the end of high school we took I think it was something that was called an aptitude test, I think, as I remember, we were told, no, this isn't testing your intelligence, this is testing your ability to, so this will help people, you know, this will help people who are called counselors, mm-hmm. I wasn't even aware of counselors, that would help you just make decisions on your life. And then these results, if you're going to be a university-bound person, would be sent to the university and they will analyze you. So as you're going to university, I'm telling the real story now, as you're going to university and you apply to the university, you're then also assigned a moment to discuss this with a counselor at the university who sort of marks out your prospects, sort of talks with you and says, well, here's the results of your aptitude tests and your tests, but they don't give them to you. And they say that, you know, then they give you some words that say, well, you have certain, you have a chance of getting through university, but maybe if you do this and apply yourself and so on.
Was that standard across Canada?
I don't know that it was across Canada, but it was certainly done at UBC and for my brothers and me. And so it must have been common. Isn't that interesting as an approach?
Very, strikes me as very British.
Fair enough. I think it was probably pure British. It couldn't happen here. I can't imagine it's that the equivalent. So I do remember the interview as we were transitioning away from high school. But before I got into UBC, you know, we had this very formal time. Okay, you're going to go see a counselor. Counselor, what do I do with that? And well, nothing. So I remember just the general saying that, how did it go? Well, I think he said that I would have to study very hard, and you know, I was about a B student, and there was some prospects that I might be able to, I might graduate. So, but I sure have to apply myself.
This is from college.
This is coming out of high school.
Okay.
So I was, yes, I'd have to apply myself, and that I had some prospects of getting out, but I'm going to have to work pretty hard to do it. That was my memory of that interview.
Oh,
isn't that interesting?
Fascinating.
Yeah. So sort of when did this sort of, if you want to call it a blossoming, occur?
Yes.
If it was a blossoming, I'm never sure. You know, you can just say, well, when, because, you know, I mean, what's so, why I share this on this is because it was really interesting then to reflect truly 55 years. Well, let's say 50 years later, they gave me an honorary degree. So I sort of thought of this and I thought,
That is really quite wonderful. I mean,
well, it really was.
Yeah,
and I thought, okay, well, something went right along the way.
So, Paul, when was the decision made that you would go to university from high school?
That's a really interesting question, too, because I think mentally I was sort of fighting it, because I had this dream of what I was.
Yes.
And it was sort of a mix of Groves Farm and something beyond the Groves Farm that I could do on my own that would just have this beautiful, idyllic connectivity with the natural world, and I would love to fish and have a salmon boat, and you know, and I'd done trapping and I knew that, and just sort of integrate in the economics of a coastal region and beautiful climates, and just loved it. And so the whole thought of leaving that didn't exist. But at the same time, I had this land that my parents were continuing to hone skills, but at the same time, it's interesting to put my parents' mind and sort of say, well, you're going to be going to university. So that came up, I think, quite naturally and I have to hand this to my parents and also the Groves, because the Groves boys were bright, and it was clear that they were going to university.
Oh.
And being at McGee High School was another important piece of it, because at McGee High School, the kids that had come through elementary school and then into this big melting pot, junior high, and then back into an even higher level, slightly even higher than our elementary in terms of potential expectation, were definitely professionally oriented. So what classes are you taking, you know, and how are your grades? These things sort of come to the surface. Well, so where are you heading? Well, UBC, okay. So it was just a very sort of, it wasn't a transition that was resisted. Some of the buddies who were in that I hung out with did not have those expectations. And clearly they did not have the academic or the intellect that I had. But you're never aware of that at that time.
Right.
Grades are not something in that system that I grew up. Marks and grades are not anywhere as important in the consciousness of the student or child, in my recollection, as they are today. Now that may be the effects of time, but yeah, I was not aware, you know, other than there were these really smart kids, that I was I could communicate. I was very much part of them, but not really the bright kids. So, you know, and being younger, and those things just didn't occur to me. So maybe, yeah, above average, but.
So the end of your report card was a minor event, not a major event?
It must have been, because I don't have any recollection of it. However, this is interesting. For my older brother, who was this, you know, the first son, who wasn't as good a student as I, quite clearly, it was a major event in the lives of our family. A major event. My father and my older brother just had it out. Every report card in his room. And if I could, you know what I mean by had it out. There, I could hear it all through the walls. I could see him, you know. So this was interesting.
Yes.
So I don't know how to, but that's a great question. It sort of brought all that out. And so I was the guy who had mostly the lines to write. You know, it was just pushing the limits probably, but had lots of essays to write. My older brother got it because he's academically wasn't achieving like my father had high expectations of everybody. And my junior, my younger brother, who eventually became, you know, I think he saw all this happening and was sort of dodging the bullets pretty well. So when I talk with them, we get together now as brothers every year or two. Just the three boys go off and have a interesting
weekend. And do you
weekend.
Still talk about the past?
That's what we talk about.
Isn't that fascinating?
It's fascinating, and it's fabulous to have that relationship.
Cole, did you, once you were going to UBC, was it in your consciousness that, oh, maybe you wish you could have gone to Carleton out in Toronto or wherever it is, or McGill?
Guelph. See, agriculture was my heading. Once I sort of coming out of the Groves farm, David Groves, the eldest of the two, went into agriculture, and he was sort of mentoring me in advance by a year or two, a couple of years. Mm-hmm. This boy that I'd met so many years earlier, and who was like a second family, second brothers, but we only saw him, you know. So, there was not, there was never, I mean, in my period, in my time, there was never a question that choices existed. That wasn't part of any experience of college. There was the university. There was no alternative, no. But it was either you were going to the university or you weren't.
So interesting. Again,
this is a time period.
It is a time
period. I'm sure it's...
Many of
you're
going to
hear that same thing for everybody.
Generation that I talked to. Well, I went to. I'm interested how often they went to a college.
Yeah.
It did not apply to 27th.
No.
Like people do today.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that wasn't part of it. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't in the. It wasn't even. Well, it wasn't in the culture. No, it wasn't in the culture.
So, Paul, what year do you graduate from high school?
55.
55.
Yeah, and so, in 55 I was 17. I mean, just becoming 17. See, I was 16 throughout my last year of high school. So I was quite young, and you were too. You said,
but, I was. Yes.
But so you know, you perhaps know some of the sorts of things we're alluding to here.
Yes.
I mean, it's retrospective. It didn't make any difference to you. You were. That's where you were.
That's just the way it was.
It's just the way it was.
So do you go to UBC that fall?
I go to UBC. And yes. And so, but prior to that, the summers were intensely on the Groves farm doing the major work of the farm, which still was a very primitive farm. It was like do your own, one tractor, no baler, hay to be put up, as I said before, the hard way, one mower on the tractor, and then a rake that raked it into windrows, and then you had to rake the windrows into hay cocks, and with a hay fork, put the cocks on a wagon or the back of the truck, and take the truck to the barn, and then put a knife, and then from the top of the barn comes this pulley, and a hay fork goes into the load of hay, pulls it up on a pulley, and then into the end of the barn, and then down into the mow, and then spread the hay from the mow, all by hand, every blessed piece by hand. Then no bales, no balers, nothing. This is hay cut grass. It was primitive frontier farming, given that they had a tractor. So it was great experience for kids.
It's so interesting. It just occurred to me now, listening to you. We've had one full session, and we've had a half session today. I would bet that you've spoken more about the Groves than any other formative influence, including your father.
They are a huge formative influence on both me and my younger brother. Is that okay to have it in there?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm just saying that's
out loud.
Oh, how interesting.
You know, to yes. about
so who is this man?
Distilling that.
Yeah, who is this man? Well, he's a product of
yes.
a very, very rich, I view it, enormously rich childhood, formative years. Just fabulous. Fabulous. The Groves were loving people. With strong views of the world and themselves in the world, but way off to the side of the common man.
So, if you had to describe the essence of what the Groves experience was for you that lasted, what would you say?
Oh, the essence was the emancipation from the restrictive environment but that my own parents put on me. Emancipation. I mean, I did all these things, but it was under very restricted limits and with high expectation, no expectation. My father never said, you know, go out and raise these things. He was much more directed toward who you knew. You know, he was a doctor who was in the process of giving up his private practice that he had after to now return to public service as a professor invited at UBC in the Faculty of Medicine to become the professor of dermatology. Huh. Isn't that interesting? So he gave up a lucrative, I'm going to say lucrative, I assume private practices were lucrative, gave that up after a relatively few years to become devoted to the public need. And if Donald Williams is not known, that's my father, in British Columbia, and I just looked at his CV before coming here, something I'd never done before. I thought, oh my God. This is what made him what he was. That helps me understand better why I am who I am. So, but you've said the Groves. Subtly and subliminally, my father had a very strong influence, but the counterpoint to that, which was much more open, was the Groves. But I think the Groves, in retrospect, were so much more open that they represent, and I look at where the Groves boys, my dear friends, my brothers, ended up and how they ended up compared to how I end up and my brothers. And I say, it was the combination. Those boys went off and they achieved academically, they had brilliance. Much more, they were much smarter than I was. But what they achieved was confused and consigned and constrained by that upbringing. They never achieved what. And, you know, if you measure achievement, and I don't mean to be measuring achievement, but I'm just saying the richness of their lives, they each have very interesting lives. The younger brother, a bizarre person still. The older brother, very interesting career, still on the farm, raising salmon fry for the farms, with a PhD from Purdue in animal nutrition, raising fry salmon to go into the farms all the way up the coast of British Columbia. Now, that farm morphed from a beef farm after the father died and so on, Tom Groves died, to Dave Grove, who then gave up his professorial position at the University of Victoria to go into farming of salmon and deer for specialized restaurants, for venison. And I went off to Wisconsin and disappeared into the United States. That's after we get through college. We haven't even got into college yet. So it's the yin and the yang of the Groves, but they were such, Mrs. Groves was such a wonderful, wonderful, warm, open-hearted woman, capable beyond belief. in terms of, she was a home ec major. And you think, yeah, I'm still talking about the Groves. But she could do anything, bake anything. Their home was always open to anyone of any time. No sense of social order in terms, they were the pillar of the community because everybody came to their house. And so as they came in, while we were little boys, they watched how they treated people. Even though they had a very strong sense of stratification, it was as though they were kind of the quintessential manor, lord of the manor, but never in that way, just open people. My parents, very much more closed, conscious of society, trying to move up in it, you know, stabilize.
So you really are a product of two families.
That's a fair analysis. That's a very fair analysis. Yeah, yeah. Isn't that interesting?
I think it is simply fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, that's almost, in a way, random.
Oh, totally random.
That it happened.
Yep, it happened on a beach at a cottage when two little boys, a quarter of a mile apart, saw each other with butterfly nets in their hands and came together and started to talk.
So while it's not fruitful, it is fun to speculate as to who you would be today had you not met the Groves.
Oh, my Lord.
Oh, it's just interesting.
It is interesting. I can't even begin to think, except that I did have that wonderful, deep experience in Vancouver with the gardening and the plants.
Yes.
And that of course, we never let go.
Right.
I mean, that just was part of me. So, you know, when I arrived here, or when I went to UBC, I mean, you're going to take horticulture and landscape architecture by professors who had never had half the exposure I did. But I wasn't conscious of that fact then. It just occurred to me later on that I had so much more as I entered than any of them had ever. But how do you know that when you arrive?
You don't.
Let me just end this.
Oh, is that being running?
No.
It's all right. I don't mind.
I
like you say, sometimes you get good
things.
Oh, yeah, you got to formally end it. Right.
This now concludes the second session with Professor Williams on January 18th, 2010.